Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's great to see everybody. The last time I had a sermon, which was I only gave one in my lifetime, was at the Jackson's home. And Jackson's, even though I love your home, it is so nice to be doing it live in front of people. And we have so many people here, I'm really thinking that we need to take up an offering or something, because it seems like a holy day, or it seems like the feast. This is actually as large as some of you probably had at the feast this year, with the rooms that you were in. Now, I've heard it said over the years that you learn a lot more from stories, that you can learn great things, great anecdotal things from stories, whether they be personal stories or whatever. But storytelling is a great way to teach, and it's a great way to impart. So today, I want to tell you some stories. So if you're taking notes, put them away, at least for now. Because I'd like to go through a series of stories to introduce my topic this afternoon. And these are personal stories, very personal stories to me, that have molded, shaped, and in some ways changed my life. When I was a little boy, and I was never really a little boy, but when I was a young boy, growing up in Providence, Rhode Island, and Mr. Jackson oftentimes refers to his growing up, his early years in the hood of Baltimore. Well, I grew up in the Italian hood in Providence, Rhode Island. We grew up with a huge network of friends in our neighborhood. And the one thing that we all loved to do was play sports. Sports was at the center of our lives. And I know you look at me now, and I am almost 60, and been through a lot in my life. I might not look like it, but when I was a young man, I was a pretty good ball player. And my wife can give testimony to that, because I was young when we were married, and my wife saw me play most of the sports that I love: baseball, basketball, and hockey. But when we were growing up in our neighborhood, we went through the seasons, and we had our sports lined up with the seasons. And for those of you that might not be into sports, you know, there's certain sports that are played during certain times of the season. And in the spring, in the summer, in the early fall, we played baseball and we played basketball. And in the winter, primarily, we played hockey. Played a little bit of football, but primarily we played hockey. And the hockey rink and the baseball diamond and the basketball court were all the street in front of my house. And I lived at 65 Devonshire Street in Providence, Rhode Island, and right in front of my house were the goals, the end zones, the basketball court, the diamond, the bases, and everything. It took place right in front of my home. Well, over the years, I tended to like and gravitate to the sport of hockey most. Hockey is an incredibly complex sport, and takes so much dexterity, so much mental acuity, so much physical demand and attention. It is just a tremendous sport. It's fast, it's hard, it's aggressive, and it's a lot of fun. And as a hockey player, growing up in my neighborhood, we played street hockey. So there wasn't ice on the street, unless it was in the winter where there was ice there, just because. We played street hockey, and we played with a hard orange ball and the other accoutrements of hockey, hockey sticks and the whole nine yards. And I, in baseball, I was a catcher. So I was used to having things come at me fast. So in hockey, I was a goalie, and I loved being a goalie. People would shoot pucks at me, shoot hard balls at me. I'd get hit, I'd get stung, I'd get hurt. I'd get hit in the head, I'd get hit in the stomach, I'd get hit in my foot, and I would leave bruised and battered after every game. But I loved hockey. And we made up our own hockey stuff. As a goalie, we didn't have the kind of money we had today to have like really real hockey pads, so we had foam rubber with belts put through them so we could tie them around our legs. I used a baseball glove instead of a real hockey mitt that they have. And all of these things were like handmade. But we were playing hockey, and I loved that sport. Well, as I moved into junior high school, actually in the eighth grade, all of a sudden there was a movement in our eighth grade year in junior high school to have a hockey tournament with all of the junior high schools in the Providence area. I think there's six of them. And there was an announcement went out for those that were interested in playing hockey to come to the gymnasium and fill out this document so you could join the team. So a whole bunch of buddies that played hockey in the street, most of whom knew how to skate, and I did not. As I mentioned, I was not a little boy, but a young boy, and I had problems skating for a whole myriad of reasons. I tried, and I just could never get the hang of skating. All of my friends said, "Mike, you got to come down and join the team." I said, "But guys, I can't skate." They said, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We'll do something." We went down, we signed up, and we got this team together in junior high school. And we got on the ice, and my knees were shaking, and my ankles were going like this, and it took three guys to carry me to the goalie net, to get me to the net, because I was pretty embarrassed to be on my all fours, kind of crawling there, because I couldn't skate. So anyway, so I got into the net. We had three or four practices. And this was the first time I ever played ice hockey, and I loved it. I loved it. And I just wished that I knew how to skate so I could, you know, do a good job at it. Make a long story short, we went into this tournament, and we won the tournament. And I was the starting goalie. I did very well, even though I couldn't skate. I didn't have to skate that much because I was in this goal, this net, and I just had to move from side to side. And I could fall down very well. I had a problem getting up. But I kept the goals out of the net, and we won that tournament. We then went into high school, and again, same group of guys, same group of friends, the nucleus. We went into high school, and the school that I went to, the high school that I went to, was a great school for learning and education. It was not a great school for hockey. They had track, they had football, they had baseball, they had basketball, but they didn't have hockey. And there was a movement underfoot, little did we know when I was a freshman in high school, to develop a hockey team at our high school, Classical High School in Providence. In 1976, they finally got the city council to pass the ability for us to have a hockey team. So in 1976, we actually had a Classical High School hockey team that was in the leagues in Providence, Rhode Island, with the other teams. We had new uniforms. We actually had equipment, like real equipment, that protected us. And we had a coach. They hired a coach from the neighboring community who had coached a couple of other pretty good teams in the past to come in and coach our hockey team. His name was John Caparco. And John was a hard-nosed, tough, grind-them-out, high expectation, militaristic sergeant who wanted one thing, and that was perfection. Perfection. We would rent the ice at 4 o'clock in the morning. So we'd have to get up at 3 o'clock, 3:15. Our friends would come through, pick us all up, put all our hockey equipment in the car. We'd head to the rink at Brown University and then Providence College, and we had the ice time at 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 to 5 or 5:30. And then we had to go home, take a shower, and go to classes. And that happened 5 days a week. We started practicing, and our coach demanded 100% of our attention and 100% of the effort that we could give. We had this one routine that we went through called Bull in the Ring. Now, you're in probably 40 pounds of equipment. As a goalie, I was probably in 70 pounds of equipment. And there would be a big ring in the center of the ice with all the hockey players and around the middle ice in a circle. And somebody would get thrown in the middle and have to fight their way out of the circle. And if they fought their way out of the circle, the person they got through had to go in the middle and try to fight their way out. Well, that was every day at practice. For a half hour when we first got in practice, we did red line, red line, red line, goal line, goal line, back, which was an exercise that was unbelievable. We had kids throwing up on the first day and the first week. It was a terrible exercise. And again, as a goalie, I had to do it with not only an extra couple of pounds on me, but an extra 70 pounds of equipment on me as well. So the goalies were always kind of lagging behind the other skaters. But for 1 month until we started our first game, we went through unbelievable torture with this coach. And he would not let up. He would not take anything less than full-out effort. He would not take anything less than complete attention to what he was asking us to do. He told us that we were going to be the best conditioned and hardest working team in the league. And because of that, we would have success. Well, to make a very long story short, that year, we actually won the city tournament, our first year in the league. And by the way, it wasn't because we had a lot of very good players. We had average players, decent players. A lot of the players like me, it was their first time playing organized ice hockey. But we won the city tournament, went into the playoffs the next 2 years of my high school, and did very well, surprising everybody. But we did so because of the unwielding demand of our coach, John Koparko. And what John told us very early on was this: believe, work harder than anyone else, and expect the results. Believe, work harder than anybody else, and expect the results. And again, the results for us were reaching the playoffs and winning the city tournament the first 2 years. And he was right, because we would get outscored 3-0, 5-1, 7-2, 9-4 in the first two periods. And then we would annihilate everybody in the third period, because we were so well conditioned and so disciplined, everybody couldn't keep up with us. Even the finest of teams couldn't keep up with us. Now, we would never win the first two periods, but we would always win the third period, and it gave us enough wins to put us in the playoffs and had the success that we did. In July of 1979, the U.S. Olympic hockey team was born. Herb Brooks, a notable hard-nosed hockey coach from Minnesota, who I believe my coach John Koparko took his lesson plan from, who ironically was cut from the 1960 Olympic team 1 day before the deadline, was at the helm. He just wanted his team to make a good showing. He just wanted his team not to embarrass themselves, or more importantly, the country that they were skating for. Not even Brooks thought they could actually beat the Russians and win the gold medal. Like my coach, John Koparko, in classical high school in Providence, Rhode Island, in 1976 and 1977, Herb Brooks worked his players to death. They hated him. They couldn't understand him. He drove them. He motivated them psychologically, emotionally, physically, to heights that they didn't even believe they could get to. They became a team. They became tough. They became resilient. And they became probably more confident than they should have been. My homework for you tonight, since unfortunately because of copyright laws, I can't play it for you tonight, this afternoon, is to go home and watch the movie Miracle, which was a Disney movie that was put out many years ago. Has anybody ever seen that movie in here? Well, if you've seen it, that's okay. Go back and see it again. Because over the last 3 months, as I've been preparing this message, I've watched the rerun of that thing probably 30 times, and all the YouTube clips on the live videos of what was one of the most momentous times in sports history and one of the momentous times in U.S. history over the last 40 years. A few weeks before the Lake Placid Olympics, the Russians beat an all-star team of USA professionals, hockey players, 2-1. They were dominant, and this was the best hockey players, professional hockey players, in the NHL at that time. And the Russians beat them, and they beat them handily. A couple of days prior to Lake Placid, there was a game in New York City that was put on for some kind of event, some kind of fundraising, where the Russians beat the U.S. 10-3. Now, if you don't know a lot about hockey, and you probably don't, 10-3 is insane. I mean, a high-scoring hockey game is 4 goals or 5 goals, not 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But the Russian team beat the Americans 10-3. The Russian team was unbelievable. The most disciplined, the most talented, the most together hockey team that anybody's ever seen. They called them the Red Wave, and they were. They were a phenomenal team, and they were like a machine. No emotion. They did everything right, and they just kept coming at you and coming at you and coming at you. The Soviet team had captured the previous four Olympic hockey golds going back to 1964 and had not lost an Olympic game since 1968. So 12 years, three Olympic Winter Olympics, they had not lost a game and had won the goal in every single one. And all of these Russian players played together. There were brothers, there were cousins, all these guys were in their late 20s, early 30s, mature men that were playing this game together for 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 years. Obviously, few had high hopes for the seventh-seeded U.S. team entering the Olympic tournament. But the team soon silenced its detractors, making it through the first and opening round of the playoffs undefeated. They had some scary moments, they had some close moments, but they won. The problem was, so were the Soviets. They were the first-seeded team, and they went undefeated with victories in the first round. On Friday afternoon, February 22nd at 5 p.m., and just like events like 9/11, just like events like Pearl Harbor, just like events of John F. Kennedy and the Challenger disaster, many of you possibly or probably remember where you were on February 22nd, 1980 at 5 p.m. It was a national event. The American amateurs and the Soviet team met before a sold-out crowd in Lake Placid, New York. And I believe there were about 8,000 to 10,000 people there, and the auditorium was electrified. It was absolutely electrified. The Soviets broke out first with their new young star, Valery Krotov, deflecting a snapshot behind the American goalie, Jim Craig, in the first period. Midway through the first period, Buzz Snyder, the only American who had previously been an Olympian, answered the Soviet goal with a high shot over the shoulder of Vladimir Tretiak, the Soviet goalie. So at the end of the first period, there was a 2-2 tie. The relentless Soviet attack continued as the period progressed, with Sergei Makarov giving his team, a 1-1 at the end of the first, giving his team a 2-1 lead. Within just a few seconds left in the first period, American Dave Christian shot the puck down the ice in desperation. Mark Johnson picked it up, sent it into the Soviet goal with 1 second remaining. After a brief Soviet protest, the goal was deemed good, and the game was tied 2-2 at the end of two. Nearly 9 minutes into the third period, Johnson took advantage of a Soviet penalty and knocked home a wild shot by Dave Silk to tie the contest again at 3-3. About a minute and a half later, Mike Arruzioni, whose name in Italian means eruption, picked up a loose puck in the Soviet zone and slammed it by Mishkin with a 25-foot wrist shot. For the first time in the game, the Americans had the lead, and the crowd erupted into celebration. And again, as you go back and you listen either to the live videos that are on YouTube or other places or watch the movie, it's impossible not to have shivers go up your spine as you watch this going on and listen to the crowd, USA, 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 10,000 people. It was thundering. There were still 10 minutes to play in the game, but the Americans held on with Jim Craig making some fabulous saves. With 5 seconds remaining, the Americans finally managed to get the puck out of their zone, and the crowd began counting down the final seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. And then Al Michaels, the announcer from ABC Sports, said, 5 seconds left. Do you believe in miracles? Yes. And the U.S. won and beat the Soviets by a score of 4-3. When the final horn had sounded, the players, coaches, and team officials poured onto the ice in a raucous celebration. The Soviet players, as awestruck as everyone else, waited patiently to shake their opponents' hands. The so-called miracle on ice was more than just an Olympic upset. To many Americans, it was an ideological victory in the Cold War, as meaningful as the Berlin airlift or the Apollo moon landing. The upset came at an auspicious time. President Jimmy Carter had just announced the U.S. was going to boycott the 1980 Summer Games in Moscow because of the Soviet invasion into Afghanistan. And the Americans, faced with a major recession in the Iran-Contra crisis, were in dire need of something to celebrate. After the game, President Carter called the players to congratulate them, and millions of Americans spent that Friday night in revelry over the triumph of our boys over the Russian pros. The U.S. hockey team was a 1,000-to-1 underdog. 1,000-to-1 underdog. And they won. After all of this played out, weeks later, there was a moment that the players talked about where Herb Brooks, their coach, came into the locker room before they went out on the ice, before they started the game, and said to the team, to the entire team, three things. You were born for this moment, you were meant for this moment, and this moment is yours. And they became the Olympic world champions. My question to you today is, do you believe in miracles? Do you believe in miracles? John Koparko, my hockey coach, taught me three things. That if you believe and you work harder than anybody else, you can expect results. Herb Brooks similarly told this U.S. hockey team of young 21, 22, 23-year-old boys from Minnesota, from Boston, from North and South Dakota, three things. That they were born for the moment, that they were meant for the moment, and that this moment was theirs. I've learned very powerfully during my lifetime that all miracles have three elements in common. Number one, believe it. Number two, work it. Number three, expect it. You know, polls say, interestingly enough, that 80% of Americans believe in miracles. 80% of Americans believe in miracles. Miracles are a normal part of the human existence. God is making himself known through the miracles that he authors. Now, I'm not suggesting that U.S. victory over the Soviets was not something that God inspired to happen, allowed to happen, and caused that miracle to happen. We'll ask him someday about that. But it was at least the miracle in the minds of those that it happened to, and to Al Michaels, the announcer that was announcing that game. You know, what do miracles do? What do miracles do? They give faith to those who receive it. They give faith to those who receive it. And they give recognition of God's existence to all of those who see it and experience it. Miracles give faith to those who receive it and recognition of God's existence to all those who see it and experience it. The definition of miracle is a surprising and welcome event that is not explicable by nature or scientific law and is therefore considered to be the work of a divine agency. A surprising and welcome event. Again, I'm not going to call what we did in high school a miracle. I wouldn't go that far. But certainly that U.S. hockey team, as Al Michaels said, was a surprising and welcome event that nobody could explain. Nobody could explain. Nobody could have ever dreamed that something like that could have happened. A miracle is also a highly improbable or extraordinary event, development, or accomplishment that brings very welcome consequences. A miracle is also an amazing product or achievement or outstanding example of something. Those all come from the definition from Oxford Languages. A number of years ago, I think probably 10 or 11 years ago now, a family was on their way to church here in the West Palm area. And they were on 95 and they were driving, and knowing the driver of that car, anything I'm sure could have been happening. But they were on 95 driving, and all of a sudden somebody swerved into their lane The driver swerved, the car tipped over, rolled a few times, and they were on their hood, upside down. And the occupants of the car were thrown around like rag dolls, and glass everywhere, metal everywhere, in the middle of 95. Now, part of the miracle that I know is the fact that everybody in that car today is alive, because some of them are here. But the other part of that miracle that's absolutely incredible, undeniable, has no explanation, was this. The first people behind that car to stop. So the car flipped. They're in the middle of the highway. All the traffic comes to a stop. The first car behind that car that flipped were members of our church here, Dale and Diane. And when Dale and Diane saw the car flip, they went over to Kathy and Teresa and my nieces and nephew. And when they looked in the car, they realized who it was. I think it took Teresa actually a couple of seconds to realize who it was when they're looking in the car. I mean, how does that happen? There's tens of thousands of cars that go down 95 every day. How does that one car from a very tiny congregation here of people in West Palm, maybe 70 to 100 at that point in time, be the exact car behind that accident? If that doesn't show God's hand at work, if that doesn't inspire the people that had it happen to them and the people that saw it, then I don't know what does. You know, there's examples all over the Bible. The Bible is a living book of examples, I mean, just of miracles. Just about everything in Scripture is a miracle. There's all kinds of stories. 161, I think, one account that I came through. But the Bible is replete of stories of miracles. The Red Sea, Gideon's army, the walls of Jericho, changing water into wine, healing the paralytic in Bethesda, feeding the 5,000, Jesus walking on water, healing the blind man, and on and on and on and on. This book is just replete with miracle after miracle after miracle. But I believe a miracle affects you very differently when it happens to you personally. And you're not just not reading it out of the books of even the Bible. God becoming real in your life and evident in your life is a very, very powerful thing. You know, interestingly enough, the word miracle in Hebrew is the word nes, N-E-S, which by its meaning in the biblical Hebrew is a symbol of victory held high for all to see. A symbol of victory held high for all to see. And what is that miracle that happened, Kathy and Teresa and Caitlin, to you guys, and Steph, to you guys, but a banner to be held high for all to see, for God's work and intervention in your life? Again, I suggest the experience of a miracle is much more powerful than words on a page. I want to briefly this afternoon, because I only have 2 hours left, I want to talk about those three concepts that I mentioned earlier. Believe it, do it, expect it. You know, it's kind of the chicken and the egg. Can we really understand a miracle until we've had one? Again, we can read it, we believe it, we know it because it's in this book, that it's true, but does a miracle take on a whole new life when we see it, when we experience it? When it happens to us, when it happens to our loved ones, when it becomes so real and so palpable that it affects your life in a very, very different way. I believe the first time we expect a miracle in our life is a very precious, important time, because it gives us a lens to look through that we've never had before and never will look through that way again. You know, referencing Peter, Jesus walking on water, the boats being tossed to and fro. They look out, there's Christ out there, you know, just walking on the waves. high, you know, probably 6, 7, 8, 9 foot waves going on out there. Everything's a mess, rain, wind, everybody's down in the barrel of the boat because they're concerned. And there's Christ walking around like he's in the garden on the waves. And certainly that's an incredible miracle, but it was Christ. It was God in the flesh. And here comes Peter. And Peter, having seen who knows how many miracles over his lifetime, during his time with Christ, having seen those miracles and experienced those miracles, here's Peter taking the step out of the boat onto the water, believing and expecting for the result to happen. And you know what? It did. It wasn't until he stopped believing that he started to sink. Let's turn to 1 Kings. 1 Kings. 1 Kings 17, and again, I could have had 19,000 scriptures to go to, and this is the one I chose for this this part here, because there's just so many of them. 1 Kings 17, and it came to pass after these things, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, was sick, and sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him. And she said unto Elijah, what would I do with thee, O thou man of God? Art thou coming to me to call my sin to remembrance and slay my son? So this woman is saying, this mother is saying to Elijah, you know, is my son dying because of some sin that I have? And are you here to, you know, exercise that result? In verse 19. And he said unto her, give me your son. And he took him out of her bosom and carried him up into a loft where he abode, and laid down upon his own bed. In verse 20, and he cried unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, has you also brought evil upon the widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son? And he stretched himself upon the child 3 times, cried unto the Lord, and said, O Lord God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again. In verse 21, and the Lord God heard the voice of Elijah. And the Lord God heard the voice of Elijah. Why did he hear the voice of Elijah? Because Elijah had faith. Elijah believed in the miracle of raising this little boy from death to life. Elijah believed the miracle, believed that God would hear him, believed that God would answer him, and expected that it would happen. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he was revived. And Elijah took the child and broke him down out of the chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, thy son lives. At some point in time in Elijah's life, Elijah had to be pressed or impressed by a miracle that he saw, and probably miracles that he saw. Elijah didn't just all of a sudden come up on his own and say, hey, how about this idea? Let me take this kid upstairs, put him down in bed, do this thing 3 times, and ask God to take care of him. Elijah had to have the faith and believe that God would hear him and that God would answer him. When I was a young boy, I started coming to church when I was 10 years old. Early on in my life, our faith was very commonsensical to me. It just made sense. It was logical. But I must say, at the age of 10 or 11 or 12, you know, I was going to church with my folks. It hadn't hit me. There was still, you know, a whole ton of stuff I didn't know, and to be frank with you, didn't care about at that point in time. But something changed my life. We had a young girl, part of a big family in our church in New England, that had a brain tumor. And every week we would go to church and we would see this young girl's tumor get bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is back in the days when doctors were persona non grata, where it didn't matter what was going on, you did not go to a doctor because that, you know, that meant you didn't have faith. In any case, the parents didn't take her to the doctor. The family didn't take her to the doctor, and she continued to get worse week after week after week. And I saw this. She was a teen. She was my age. I saw this happening every single Sabbath. She continued to get worse and worse and worse. And finally, towards the end, that tumor was the size of a softball hanging out the side of her head. The family invited us all to their house one Sabbath after church, all for all the kids to come over and ostensibly say goodbye to Lisa. And there were probably 100 kids there. This is prior to YOU. But we had a huge young adult and teen contingent in that area. And there's probably 100 of us at that house. And we were downstairs, and the family was feeding us, and we were talking, and two by two, or three by three, or four by four, we made our way up the stairs into Lisa's room. And when you walked in that room, you could smell death. You could smell the flesh rotting on her head from this tumor. And I went up with a couple of friends, and we sat on the bed, and we talked to Lisa a little bit, who was actually very pleasant, considering everything that's going on is a miracle in and of itself. And we all said what we needed to say, believing that was the last time that we would see her. We went home, went to bed, pretty serious situation for a young 12-year-old to go through. And the next morning I woke up early, and my dad was, we had this this sun parlor that looked out at the front of our house onto the street. And my dad would do his Bible study there, and he'd sit there at the desk and look out at the neighborhood. I got up about 7 o'clock, 7:15, and I heard something, and I walked in out of my bedroom into the kitchen where I could see down the hallway into where my dad was sitting, and I saw my dad sitting at the desk, sobbing. And I know my dad's movements, and my dad, when he would cry, his whole body would just shake. And I saw his chest and his shoulders going up and down. And I knew something was up, and I assumed, based on what we had gone through, that Lisa had passed. My dad got off of the phone, and I said, "What happened? Who was that?" He said, "It was the family." And I said, "Is she dead?" And he said, "No, she's alive." I said, "Well, why are you crying?" He said, "Well, the tumor's gone." He said, "They went in the room the next morning, and the tumor was completely gone. No more tumor." And I said, "Dad, come on. Come on. We were just there yesterday. I said, I mean, come on. What are you telling me the tumor's gone?" He said, "Mike," he said, "the tumor's gone." So that was at a time in the church where we would have Bible studies every Wednesday. So we went to Bible study. We got there, and in the door walks Lisa with beautiful hair and a beautiful head and no tumor. If that wasn't a miracle, I don't know what was. And let me tell you something. That's the first miracle I experienced in my life. And it might as well have been the last one. And I would always, always believe that there was another one around the corner because of that experience. So when was your first miracle? Do you remember? Do you know? Can you think about it? Do you try to think about it? Do you try to meditate about it? Do you try to pray about it? Can you remember the first time that you directly experienced a miracle? And in result, what that did for you, what that did to your faith. Now, I was taught by my two hockey coaches, and the USA hockey team was taught by their coach, nothing to do with God, nothing to do with a spiritual miracle, but we were taught to believe. To believe passionately in what we were doing and what our mission was. How well do you believe it? And is that the one thing that maybe is keeping a miracle from happening in your life? Or another miracle from happening in your life? Or more miracles to happen in your life? Now, I remember a time in the church, quote unquote, in our fellowships, where there would be constant discussion in congregations, from the pulpit, from everywhere, about miracles that were happening. Maybe because they were happening more, I don't know. I don't believe that's the case. But people were more open to discuss them and talk about them. Do you believe in miracles? Do you remember your first miracle and how that changed your life? I certainly hope so, because if you don't, you're missing out on something big. Number two, do you work it? Do you work it? There is something that God is expecting. God is expecting for us to step out. God is expecting us to call the elders of the church to come and pray. Let me slide in here a little editorial comment, if I may. And of course, nobody here is included. But why is it sometimes we feel so, I don't know what the word is, but why do we not call for anointing more than we do? You know, I saw this young girl healed from a tumor. And let me tell you something. When I get sick, or there is the least little thing wrong with me that's causing me discomfort, I know there is relief right around the corner. The blessing that we have, the opportunity that we have to call on God's ministers and to call on Jesus Christ for his broken body and his stripes and his blood to heal us is incredible. But we have to ask for it. We have to work it. We have to do something. We have a role to play. We talk about it all the time, the prayer, the fasting, the meditation, the study, the stepping out and the doing that we must do to be part of the equation. Let's turn to Luke 8. Luke 8. Luke 8 and verse 43. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. This woman did something. She stepped out. She did something. She touched the hem of his garments. And because she did that, because she exercised her faith, because she believed it and she went to the next step and exercised her faith, she was healed. And immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, Who was it that touched me? When all denied it, Peter said, Master, the crowds surround you and pressing in on you. But Jesus said, Someone touched me, for I perceived that the power had gone out of me. And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him and declared in the presence of all the people that she had stepped out, that she had acted on her faith, and that she had touched him, and she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. You know, it's one thing to believe in miracles. It's another thing to do your part in the miracle process. And whether that's calling for the elders of the church for anointing, or whether that's taking part of your destiny in your own hands and doing the things that you should do and behaving in the way that you should behave, we do have responsibility in the process to have the miracles happen in our lives the way we would like them and the way probably that they should. My parents were on a trip, and I'm not quite sure if a business trip or coming. Matter of fact, I think it was coming back from the feast. And this was probably back in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s. I don't think Sam and I were married yet. And this was before cell phones and, you know, car phones and anything else. My parents were coming through New York City, and they got stuck on on 95 in New York City. I think it was right after the GW Bridge, but it was in not such a nice area, not someplace you want to get stuck on. And they got stuck on this highway at about 11 o'clock at night. So there wasn't a lot of traffic, even though it was New York City on 95, there wasn't a lot of traffic going back and forth. And they were stuck in the high-speed lane, in the berm on the high-speed lane, because my father lost a tire. So my father and my mom saying to my dad, Bill, what are we going to do? Bill, what are we, for those of you who knew my mom, what are we going to do? And my father said, Feb, we're going to pray. So they did. They prayed. A couple minutes later, they see headlights behind their car pull up behind them. And again, being in New York City, in this part of this roadway in New York City, you know, they didn't quite know exactly what was going to happen after that. This person gets out of the car. My father goes to the back of the car to meet him. And this gentleman says, you know, I see you got a problem. He said, there's a station a couple miles up the road. Let me take your tire. I'll go get it patched and I'll bring it back to you. And my father really didn't have a choice because he had to get that tire patched. He gave him the tire. He got back in the car. My mother said, why are you giving this guy the tire? He said, what are you doing? He's going to probably take off with it and be back. And now we're really in trouble. And my father said, Feb, just relax. Just have faith. Well, about a half hour later, here comes the guy back, pulling up behind my father. I'm sure my father said, see? He got out of the car, went to the back of the car. This guy takes the tire, and my father says, you know, thank you so very much. And he said, well, let me put it on for you. My father said, no, don't worry. But he said, look, let me put it on, no problem. So he puts the car on, he's putting the tire on the car, and just as he's finishing, he tightened up all the lug wrenches, and my father starts to go back into the car to pull out some cash to give to the guy. He goes into the car, opens his wallet, takes the cash out, turns around, and the car is gone. The car is gone. The tire's on my dad's car, but that car is gone. And it was impossible for that car and that guy to be gone in a matter of 3 seconds from when my dad went in the car. It was a miracle. And my dad knew it, and obviously my mom did, because she could see what was going on as well. You know, it was interesting. As I was preparing for this message back a number of months ago, when I thought I was going to give it and then didn't, I had contacted a whole bunch of people, friends that I have in the faith, and some not in our faith, to give me some examples of miracles that had happened in their lives. And ostensibly what I wanted to do was I wanted to have people do selfie videos of the miracle, and I wanted to show them as I was going through, but that didn't work out. But one of the things that was curious is that I found a number of people telling me about experiences exactly the same, about people having the miracle of having an angel, which it had to have been, appear to them, do something with them and for them, and then in a split second, being gone. You know, if you had never had a miracle happen in your life and that happened, would you need any more? But again, we have to do something to expect that. My father prayed. My father had the faith that something would be done, and it was. When Sam and I were young parents, and Sam was pregnant with Aaron, she was in a lot of distress in her pregnancy. Sam was very big. I mean, very big. And she was, I think, 2 weeks late with Aaron, and she had to go in the hospital, and they're having all kinds of problems, and Aaron's blood pressure was rising, her heartbeat was dropping, and they thought they were going to have to do a C-section. Well, finally, Aaron came flying out of Sam's womb, but was in a lot of distress. And the nurses gave Aaron to me for about 10 seconds. They never gave her to Sam because Aaron was in a lot of distress. We didn't know how badly. They gave her to me for about 10 seconds and then took her away from us. Sam went upstairs into the room. I went up with her and then went home to get a couple hours sleep. And I had called our pastor that night before and asked him if he would meet me at the hospital to come and anoint Aaron, because I knew Aaron was in distress, although I didn't know how badly till I got back to the hospital the next morning. So our pastor met us at the hospital. We met in the parking lot. We walked up into Sam's room, only to see the doctor at the foot of the bed telling Sam and then me as I walked into the room that Aaron was not doing well and that had a 30% chance of surviving. I was shocked. It was beyond belief. But we had called for the elders of the church to come and anoint. And I had seen enough miracles in my life that I knew if it was God's will, that he could change that in a heartbeat, in a hurry. Sam was a wreck. Of course, she was in bed. She couldn't come downstairs with us. Our pastor and I walked downstairs. We walked into the pediatric ICU, and we were met by the doctor in charge. And he greeted me, and he said, "You, Mr. Moore?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I want you to come over and look at Aaron's x-rays of her lungs." And we walked over to the x-ray thing on the wall, and he showed us Aaron's lungs, and they were full of pneumonia. They were completely white. And he explained to us what that was and what that meant. And he said, "Look," he said, "you know, this is very touch and go. It could go either way. The next 24 hours are, you know, very important." So we walked over to my daughter's bed, and the pastor prayed over her and anointed her. And you know, I had every belief that she would be healed, every belief. I just was hoping that God would, it would be in his will to do that. We sat there and we talked a little bit, myself and our pastor, and a couple minutes later, the doctor walked over, and the doctor said, "Mr. Moore, I want you to come back over here for a second." And we walked back over to the x-rays. He said, "Right before you came down here, about 10 minutes before you came down here," he said, "we took a new set of x-rays." He said, "Just 15 minutes ago." He said, "And I want you to see this." And he turned the x-rays on, and her lungs were completely clear. Not one sign of pneumonia. And he said, "This is a miracle." And I looked at Tom Fitzpatrick, our pastor, and he looked at me, and we said, "We know." You know, not only do you have to believe it, but you have to work at it. You have to do something. You have to act out. You have to be part of the process. Number three is you have to expect it. You have to expect the miracle. Believe it, do your part, work at it, and expect it. You know, it's kind of easy to believe in miracles, especially after they've happened. And it's kind of easy to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, Mr. Jackson, can you come over? I got a migraine, or I got something wrong with me." You know, it's pretty easy to do that. But then to expect God to respond the way you want is a whole nother ballgame. That is a whole nother ballgame. I believe in miracles passionately. I believe in doing my part, and I try to. But I don't necessarily expect God to answer my prayers the way he wants to, the way I want him to all the time. But should we? Should we? The more you know the miracle will happen, the more likely that it will. The more you know, not believe, but the more you know the miracle will happen, the more likely that it will. Let's turn to Exodus 14. Let's turn to Exodus 14. Again, dozens and dozens and dozens of scripture we can turn to for to see miracles play out and the miracles happen and to see these elements, the belief and the working and the expectation. But this is really a cool one. Exodus 14, verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. You know what? First of all, Moses believed that he could do that. He'd be looking pretty funny if he didn't believe that that could be done. Number two, he did what he had to do. He stretched out his hand. He did something. He was part of the process. And you know what? Another aspect of this too is with Moses standing there and stretching out his hand, everybody else could see what he was doing. So he was really out on a limb. And if he didn't get a direct result back from that, or an answer back from that, he would have looked pretty silly. But you have to know and you have to believe that he believed that that result was going to happen. He believed that that result was going to happen, that those waters would be split right in the middle and they'd be able to walk through. Is there any miracle that's bigger than any other miracle? They're all pretty cool. They're all pretty big. But Moses obviously knew what the result was going to be. When we pray and we fast and we meditate and we believe and we do our part, are we expecting the result? Or are we saying, you know what, it would be really nice. It'd be really nice, God, if you could hear this prayer and do this for me or do this for us. But do we really believe that that's the result that's going to happen? A number of months ago, as you've all heard many times over the last few months, we had a sister in Christ, a very, 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 very dear friend, family member of ours, contract COVID back in June. And you've all heard me talk about Linda. But I want to talk about Linda one more time, because if I can't talk about it in context of this message, I could never mention her name again. Linda was in a position in her life medically where she was really somebody that was on the hit list of somebody you did not want to get COVID. She had a lot of issues, a lot of physical issues, a lot of medical issues that would put her, as far as the medical industry would have said, in jeopardy. Somebody that did not want to get COVID. Well, Linda was sick for about a week and we were talking on the phone. She sounded terrible. She said she had talked to the doctor. The doctor said it was bronchitis. And then I get a call on, I think it was a Tuesday morning, from her husband, Tommy, saying, Mike, the ambulance is here. They're taking Linda to the hospital. She's not doing well. She can't breathe. Tommy and I talked for 20 more seconds. We both said we kind of understood or believed or thought we knew what was going on, considering everything that was going on with COVID. And she had turns out to be all the signs of and the conditions of having COVID. She got into the hospital. Within 12 hours, they put her on a ventilator and then put her in a fentanyl coma for 5 weeks. And for 5 weeks, Linda was in this fentanyl coma on a ventilator, struggling for her life. And I'll tell you what, I've gone through a lot of things in my life. Death of parents, close calls with children, problems in our faith, and a lot of other things. And I don't think I've prayed as hard as I prayed for this time with Linda. And I knew and I believed that God could heal her. And I tried to do my part with fasting and prayer and talking to other people and talking with you guys and asking you guys to pray for her as well. I tried to do my part and tried to do the things necessary. So did Tommy. So did her wonderful husband as well. But we also knew that this thing was real. This COVID thing was real. And that it was killing people. And that it was killing people that had all the kind of symptoms and issues that Linda had. And this was a very desperate situation. And I certainly did not want to see my friend pass. Her husband was out of his mind with the thought of losing his wife. But we both realized that it was a possibility. And I think we both got to the point after 4 or 5 weeks that that was a possibility. And Linda continued to be in the coma. The doctors would come in. They were doing brain scans on her. They thought she might have had strokes. They thought she had lost her mental acuity. She lost her mind. She was not getting any better. And it got to the point where the doctors finally had talked Tommy into pulling the plug. And Tommy and I would talk multiple times daily, nightly, 4:30 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, multiple times during the day. We'd talk family members and you know, just looking for something, some resolve, some help, some something. And Tommy finally made the decision on a Sunday morning at 12 o'clock because the last thing he wanted to see was his Linda in pain and his Linda suffering. Tommy had finally made the decision that he thought was the right decision at that point in time. And I could not concur. I told Sam what was going on. And I think I might have mentioned this a number of months ago. I told Sam what was going on, and Sam said, "She will not die. She will not die." And Sam believed that with every fiber of her being. And I believe today that maybe, just maybe, because of that conviction, Linda's alive, because Sam believed so strongly. But other people that were saying that as well, I don't know. She has a lot of great people around her. But Sam had the conviction that she would not die. Linda is now home, going through therapy, doing very, very well, and very much alive. So, do you believe in miracles? We've all experienced miracles in our lives, but are we and do we recognize them and acknowledge the very real, legitimate author of those miracles? Do we talk about them? Do we revere them? Do we pass on the power of those events to others around us? What is the answer to that question? You know, the Bible is not so much a book about what God did. The Bible is not so much a book about what God did, but what he is doing and what he will do. If we read it as a book of, you know, stories from a long time ago, we lose so much of what God is trying to tell us. The Bible is not so much a book about what God did, but what he is doing and what he will do. I want to read you a letter in closing. This letter was written on March 1st, 2019. It was an email. And it was sent to me by one of our longtime employees at our company. And this letter came at a very, very difficult time when, about a year ago, when the economy was doing some pretty rotten things, and our company was hemorrhaging. And we had gone through, you know, many, many things during our work history with our company, been right on the edge a lot of times, as most small business owners, I think, are. But this was a pretty brutal time. This was a time that had some things incorporated in it that we had never experienced or we had never seen. And we always had, you know, the faith and the confidence that that God provided for us. God's hand's been in our business since we've begun. It's abundantly obvious. But this was a very, very different time. And this individual that wrote this email had worked for us for 25 years. And I want to read you in conclusion the email that she wrote. "With this layoff and all that's going on, please don't take this as goodbye. After 25 years, we're not co-workers, we're family. And I love you with all my heart. I'm not sad for me. I am sad for the company that I've been so proud to work for all these years. Mostly, I'm heartbroken for you and for all that you've done to try to keep the company going. Don't stop trying. I believe in the company. I believe in you. But most importantly, I believe in the power of prayer and God's blessing. I don't know what his plan is, but hopefully we will see a miracle work through you and allow you to recoup and make us stronger. Please don't let this put anything between us. We're still family, and we should not feel we have to avoid each other. No hard feelings. May the Holy Spirit be within you and guide you. Open your heart to hear him. Know I continue to pray for you and pray for a miracle. Thank you for taking me in, making me family, and all that you've done for and have been there through the many years. Last, I always will be here for you. Always be strong. I love you. Let's consider three things. Let's believe in the miracle. Let's work for the miracle. And let's expect the miracle. And as Al Michaels said on that fateful Friday afternoon of February 22nd in 1980, do you believe in miracles? And he answered his own question by saying, yes.